And we're rolling.
All right.
Hey, Matthew.
How you doing?
Good, good. So this is Mark Goldberg here with UNDispatch.com and the American Prospect magazine.
And Matthew Lee from InnerCityPress.com from the at the United Nations, ready for blogging.
All right. Another UN Gabfest.
Sure.
Let's do it. So first things first, I think news of the day is a vote on Kosovo. I've learned it has just been postponed for tomorrow. Now, late last night, the United States and the European Union put together a final draft, they said, of a plan that would, that at least the Russians feel, might set the stage for Kosovo independence. And at the last minute, I guess not surprisingly, the Russian ambassador to the UN signaled that he might, in fact, veto this resolution. Am I right so far? That
no, you are, and I think it was pretty much no surprise at all that he said that. It's almost like I think it's kabuki theater is a term that gets overused, but there's an element of theater here because Russia has never indicated at all that it's not vetoing this as proposed. So what a lot of people said is that, and today with the vote being postponed, it's the proponents trying to feel out if Russia would stand alone, i.e. be the only country not to vote in favor, in which case it still wouldn't pass the Security Council, but it would give it would give more momentum to a process either to try to do something through the EU or to somehow isolate Russia as standalone.
Well, that's the thing. This resolution would, I guess, in essence, transfer authority over Kosovo to the European Union. And, Russia would lose its ability to steer events in its favor should that happen. So I think this is one of the principal reasons why they're fearful that that this resolution goes through. Now, interestingly, in Lisbon today, Condoleezza Rice said that, Kosovo is going to get its independence one way or another.
That's the line.
Suggesting that, maybe the U.S. and perhaps even the European Union is ready to move beyond the Security Council with the Kosovo debate.
Right, and then just exactly, have Kosovo.
Time out, Matthew. Light in the office. I mean, it's on a motion detector, and I've been.
You're in the dark.
Sort of still.
Let me jump in there then. No, I'm just joking. Go ahead. No, that's fine.
Okay. One second. Well, I'm sure they'll edit this out here. One second.
Oh, really? let me say some profanity.
There it is.
Too little.
I think sort of apparently in the office I'm in here, the motion detector is faulty or it's sort of not sensitive enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess if you see me waving my arms, viewers,
okay.
it's not because I've given up to Matthew here. It's because I'm trying to illuminate the room.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they'll edit this out, hopefully. So where were we? We were talking about
that things could move. I was going to make sure that without the Security Council acting or with total gridlock and a veto in the Security Council, I think that what Condoleezza Rice is alluding to is the idea of Kosovo declaring its independence and being immediately recognized by the United States and many other countries.
Yeah.
And
well, I guess the one challenge to that idea is which European countries would support Kosovo's independence and which wouldn't, because right now the European Union is essentially funding Kosovo's rebuilding the nation building projects in Kosovo, and if the Kosovars declare independence unilaterally, there's this chance that some of that funding might dry up because each country is going to have to decide on its own whether or not to decide to recognize Kosovo absent the UN process. So it's fraught with peril.
I think that
the
one thing I would say is, and it's sort of I think that the not even just most countries on the Security Council, but not all. I mean, I'll go back to that, but I most journalists here, I think, you know, most people that I know, I would say, are it's a no-brainer for them that Kosovo should be independent. You know, and it goes back to what people saw on, you know, on their TV screens in the late 90s and a sense of, you know, self-determination, et cetera. It's clearly, if you had a referendum today in Kosovo, it would pass overwhelmingly for independence. But, and not just to be devil's advocate, Russia, this was most recently put forward by their deputy foreign minister, I guess, Denisov, who used to be an ambassador here. He said you have to, you know, he kind of went philosophic with it, which is that you have to choose which has priority, self-determination, if people want it, or the territorial integrity of states. And so in this case, what that means is that Kosovo is, you know, they call it Kosovo, Serbia. It was a part of Serbia. I mean, there are historical arguments both ways, but I think most people are saying, you know, the idea is that, well, they, you know, if you have a poll, they want self-determination. I mean, the argument's a little more complex, but Russia's argument is if in this case you choose self-determination over the territorial integrity of Serbia, why don't you do the same thing in, there are two parts of Georgia that if you had referendums would want to be independent. Abkhazia is one, the other is South Ossetia. Yeah. There's a part of Moldova called Transnistria, same thing. Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan. And there are various, so I think that although they are a bit isolated in terms of their veto, to me at least, and I think to most students of logic, it's not a bad. It makes you scratch your head and say, even if you're, you know, like in this case. So okay, great, independence. The whole UN thing though has usually been about integrity of states. They said it all the time. You read resolutions and it says, you know, in furtherance of the territorial integrity of Georgia or whatever state it's talking about.
Mm-hmm. So it's guess one could argue that responsibility to protect measure that passed in 2005 goes against that grain. That in fact, you know, the sovereignty is in fact can be violated in certain. And that was like a big step forward for the organization. But to get back to your point about Kosovo, it seems that at this point in sort of like world history, where we are now, there's so much that the United States, at least, needs to have Russia on its side for, including most pressingly, it seems, Iran, and this is just one additional issue between the two countries that is potential to undermine the kind of cooperation the United States needs elsewhere.
Sure. Oh no. I mean, there exactly. It has it. But not only am I in favor of the responsibility to protect, that definitely passed. I think the Russian argument's a little. It's more subtle because it says, okay, you can do it. It can be done. But once if you're saying self-determination is more important than it, then why doesn't it apply? What's the standard? Why don't we just have a referendum in Western Sahara? There's another country, right? It's an ongoing struggle. Morocco kind of grabbed it, people phrase it different ways. But the whole UN system is basically siding with a plan that does not give people in Western Sahara a chance to vote for independence.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of, and the argument they use, it comes down, as most unclear arguments do, to hiding behind a Latin phrase. And the Latin phrase is sui generis. They say Kosovo stands alone. It's a unique case. There's no reason to look at it as a precedent. And then when you ask them, as I've done at the stakeout, I've tried to say, okay, what makes it unique? And they say, well, the whole history and the fact that the UN has essentially run it since 1999.
Yeah.
But so has Georgia. So at Western, I mean, not in exactly the same way. I guess the point is, and then when I, you know, some people come up to me and say, what are you, pro-Russian? And it's like, no. But I think that argument is a kind of a grabber, and I'll be honest with you, I've yet, despite the big minds over here, to hear, maybe you'll advance one, to hear a kind of compelling argument of why in that choice between self-determination, territorial integrity, why this case is so unique. Why isn't
there
a precedent?
I think its most proximate example is East Timor.
Mm-hmm.
And in both cases, you know, both countries, both nascent countries, or both provinces, I should say, were trustees of the United Nations. They, the United Nations were trustees of their territory.
Mm-hmm.
The United Nations provided all of the political and military and security infrastructure to build this country up. And I guess theoretically you could say that the citizens of East Timor and of Kosovo, like, temporarily ceded their autonomy to the United Nations as the United Nations, you know, acted in their interests mm-hmm. to build up the country. However, you know, they never thought that they would cede control to the United Nations forever. Mm-hmm. I think underlying this tacit agreement between the populations and the United Nations is the fact that, you know, eventually these countries are going to get their autonomy. And how it's different from places like Western Sahara or Georgia is that, you know, the United Nations is the sort of sole authority in charge in Kosovo. It is, like, the ultimate arbiter of all that happens in Kosovo as, like, the local Kosovar politics builds up. So it's the UN is the final authority, and it would seem to be almost dictatorial to say that, you know, we can be here forever and not take the local population's interests into account.
Sure. No, I mean, you've done better than most at the stakeout. The only thing I'd say is that by that logic, then the decision about Kosovo becoming independent was basically made in 1999 when the UN UNMIC took over running Kosovo, and that Serbia should have understood that mm-hmm. They didn't really consent to it. That they were driven out. There was NATO bombing, etc. But they should have understood that the moment that happened, there was a chance that that part of what they perceived to be their country would never come back to them. And again, I want to say, maybe I am being devil's advocate here because I'm in favor of independent, you know, self-determination. I just think that I'll just go one step further. One of the problems with this logic is that not to at all side with President al-Bashir of Sudan, but now you mm-hmm. start to see why a country that has a humanitarian crisis and as well as a genocide crisis, like Darfur, why they, just as a country trying to protect the size of their country, would say, wait a mm-hmm. minute, once you let the UN in, the next thing you know, they're voting to carve off a piece of your country. I mean, the thing of it being a precedent is not just sort of mm-hmm. an argument for, you know, smarty pants separatists in Georgia, but it's to say, let's say in future cases where you want to, unless you're willing to go in by force into Darfur, it looks like Ban Ki-moon and them are trying to convince the president of Sudan to let UN people in. Mm-hmm. The more you say, oh, but in Kosovo, because we've been there so long, so sad, you leave a part of your country, you're going to end up finding less countries consenting to UN peacekeeping missions.
I think they sort of, like, theoretically at least mm-hmm. lose their ability to not consent
right.
to sort of these nation building exercises or peacekeeping missions when they violate the human rights of their own populations on, you know, the scale that occurred in Kosovo and that's occurring in Darfur. You know, the government of Serbia and the government of Sudan has, not lived up to its responsibilities as a government should in taking care of its own people. And so,
but where do we go with that? In Uganda, the argument of this horrendous group, the Lord's Resistance Army, which kidnapped children and is about, their argument was that northern Uganda was misserved, oppressed, and left to rot by the central government in Kampala. And even people that despise the Lord's Resistance Army agree that that's what happened in northern Uganda. So it's kind of, again, I'm not, I think, maybe I'm being too looking at it, but it's sort of, I do think that it's sometimes something that seems like a no-brainer. I mean, I think it's going to be probably, you know, with all the it's a good thing when people that want to be independent get it. It's great, you know what I mean? But mm-hmm. it's all these, it's not like the other problems don't exist. And sort of, I mean, you've done, thanks a lot for walking through that, but I'll say, over here, it's just sort of like waved like a wand, like, this is a one-off. It's Ban Ki-moon was asked this question directly. He did a press conference on Monday of this week, and he said, of course it's not a precedent. And it's just sort of like, just saying it doesn't make it so, you know? And it's not a logical, it's not a logic class, but I think one of his big claims since mm-hmm. he's been in the last 6 months is that he somehow convinced President al-Bashir of Sudan to allow the UN in. I mean, they cite this when they're under attack for ineptitude in other fields. They say, but look what we did in that. And there's no, I don't think it's conceivable that this doesn't make people like the president of Sudan less likely to want the UN in. And he's even said it publicly. He mm-hmm. he doesn't blame it on the UN. He blames the U.S. He says the U.S. wants to carve Sudan into five pieces.
Right.
Right?
I agree with most of what you're saying, but I guess I just go, back to that original point that, once you have a government that's been as irresponsible as the government of the former Yugoslavia and the government of Sudan is. You know, they lose their right to have a veto over whether or not foreign soldiers or international organizations like the UN can come into their country to help their citizens.
I think that that's I'd end it with a kind of a all the lofty debates in the world. Somebody has explained it to me as follows: that in the UN system, you know, sovereignty and territorial integrity almost always wins, but that Serbia acted so badly in the Balkan War that they lost that right this time. The way it was explained to me, this is by a diplomat. He didn't cite to, you know, the responsibility to protect or any GA resolution. He just said, like, that's usually true, but every once in a while a country is either acts or is perceived to act so much worse than its adversary that you lose your rights, you know?
Yes. Yes, and you know, and also you know, it bears pointing out that you know the original NATO bombing campaign was not sanctioned by the Security Council.
Right. No, exactly.
And so you know, there was like a de facto, you know, situation on the ground that required the UN, you know, to do something about it after the fact. You know, and the day the NATO bombing stopped, the Security Council then approved the United Nations mission in Kosovo.
Right. Right. No. Exactly. Well, you could almost like, I mean, just here, I haven't really thought this one through, but it would be like the U.S. invading Iraq, and then like, well, sort of, and then immediately saying, oh, but now the UN, which didn't permit it in the first instance, should go in and run it. Which I think actually is, maybe this is a transition point. I think that's currently, that's certainly what Ambassador Khalilzad of the U.S. has been saying. He said that he's gotten Ban Ki-moon's agreement that the UN should take a much more prominent role in Iraq and should become a mediator to forestall the possibility of the country splitting up into three.
Well, I mean, that was a role envisaged for, that was a role for the United Nations envisaged by the Iraq Study Group.
Yep.
It was also, a role that was, you know, carved out by Carlos Pascual and Larry Diamond of the Brookings Institute, who have said that, you know, the UN is this neutral platform that all sides ought to use, and you know, to forge some sort of regional and internal Iraqi political dialogue, and there's a lot of potential there. Of course, you know, the question is whether or not, you know, the U.S. government at the highest levels, like President Bush, is willing to you know, carve out that role for the UN. It's not something the UN could do on its own. It needs to be given that authority by the United States and, you know, Iraqi neighbors as well.
But I also, and this may be from just spending too much time in the UN talking to people that work here, but I think there's also, and I don't, in the big picture of international diplomacy, I guess the views of like UN staff and this is not are not that dispositive, but there's a big, you know, because of the bombing that took place and the UN staff that were killed there, there's a lot of, I mean, I think it's sort of taken for granted, like when we say the UN, who do we mean? Ban Ki-moon, the people that work in the Secretariat, members of the Security Council. I don't think it's a slam dunk that the UN, at least all of those components, want that role. At least as and some of that is fear, and some of that is not wanting to be kind of, you know, used in the way like the U.S. caused the problem, but now you go and solve it.
Or, you know, and it's not as if the UN's mediation is a magic bullet either, and they could very easily be blamed for failure, which is a very real option in Iraq.
Certainly Al-Qaeda would say. Remember when there was talk of peacekeepers going to Darfur, I think that, I don't know if it was al-Zawahiri or Osama from, you know, beyond the veil, but somebody said the UN will be our target, you know?
Yeah. And that was, it also bears worth mentioning while we're talking about Iraq is, you know, a lot of times what we mean by the UN is also UN agencies. Mm-hmm. Like UNICEF or the High Commission on Refugees.
Yep.
And in fact, you know, those agencies are playing a very large role, not necessarily in Iraq, but mitigating the humanitarian crisis stemming from Iraq. You know, there's something like 2 million refugees, most of whom are living in Syria and Jordan right now, and I think another 40,000 to 50,000 flee each month, mostly to Syria and Jordan. And it's really, you know, the work of UNICARE and UNICEF is the only organizations in the world looking out for the interests of these refugees, and you know, they're banging on the door of donor nations who are not always coughing up enough support. And you know, interestingly, actually, yesterday I read that UNHCR they're kind of frustrated that donor governments aren't living up to pledges they made last April to help with Iraqi refugees, and they're urging countries to give direct bilateral support to Jordan and to Syria. Mm-hmm. To help, because they themselves, they're beyond capacity. They are arguing that, you know, that there need to be hospitals and schools built in Syria and Jordan, and those governments don't have the ability to do that on their own, and so they need, all the help they can get. And of course, this raises an interesting question, is whether or not the United States is willing to give money to Syria to help them build schools, which I'm sure they're not. Yeah.
Or even beyond. I agree that they're doing great work in there. And the reality, there's also the question of whether not just the U.S., but countries in Europe are themselves being willing, where applicable, to take enough refugees. I mean, there's something.
Yeah.
I just sort of stumbled. This is the way, you know. We had an opportunity to ask questions of the ambassador of Switzerland. So I did a little research.
Okay.
And it turned out there was a contingent, or I think they called it a contingent. It was not a military contingent. 500 Iraqis that had applied and were for essentially asylum. Right. I mean, I think if you're coming from Iraq, it's pretty. Almost anyone, regardless of political persuasion or brand of Islam or anything, could say, I'm likely to be killed if I return to my country, just based on the odds. But Switzerland did not. They ended up, first it was implied that somehow they might let in this 500 as a, and then they've gone back to say, well, no, they'll look on each one on a case-by-case basis. So it's, I think the doors of Europe and also the United States are not sufficiently open. If you cause this kind of conflagration, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also Switzerland has never been the easiest country to enter.
No, I know. That's why this one was sort of, they actually were kind of embarrassed because the ambassador tried to say, oh, it's don't write that yet. I think we're going to let in the 500. And then I asked UNHCR, and they were like, no, never happened.
No, yeah, you know? So next topic, you pick it.
Okay. Even though I want to, I definitely, we're going to get to, Ban Ki-moon and how he's being viewed. The one thing, it's actually being forgotten over here. Is Somalia, which is one of the hotter, I don't know if you're going to call it a war or insurgencies, but I think people, it was in people's, maybe it was in people, maybe it was never, Black Hawk Down is mentioned in almost like every story written in the U.S. about it, but that was a while ago. But it's been, the Islamic courts, a fundamentalist Islamic coalition of Islamic courts, took over, or some people say imposed order on Central and South Somalia, throughout last year, and then in December was ousted by essentially Ethiopian troops, putting this UN-created government back in power in Mogadishu. That's when, if people were paying attention, they might have thought, like, okay, it's done. It's not done, because the whether they're called the Islamic courts or insurgents or just Somali nationalists, there have been increasing daily, car bombings, grenade tossings, mortar firings at the Ethiopian troops, and even UN officials have gone to visit, like the John Holmes, the head of humanitarian affairs.
Wait, lights went out.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay.
You got
hold on a second. Okay.
All right. No.
Back on. Apologies.
But the big,
continue.
I think the news hook. Yeah. There is National Reconciliation Congress that was supposed to begin on Sunday. It had been supposed to begin in April, and then it was supposed to begin in June. It keeps getting canceled for two reasons. One, because of the violence, so nobody wants to go.
Yeah.
And two, because not enough money. And in part, that's donor nations are not coming through. But also, I'll say this, just as I write about Somalia, so people mostly, send me stuff, they were asking for this budget for the conference included, like, poetry shows and theater and $150,000 for lubricants, which I think is motor oil, I think. But I mean, so the weird thing is you have that, it's a country that everyone sort of shakes their head when they hear it and they say, oh, 14 years, and the international community has to do something. But the reality is one, many people there feel that the Congress is not going to be inclusive enough. It's sort of like in Iraq, you could get all the people that are not firing guns to meet in a room. But the people that you need in the room are the ones firing the guns. Otherwise, the guns are just going to keep being fired. And it's the same thing as Somalia.
Let me ask. How, in your opinion, amenable to some sort of grand political compromise is the Islamic Courts Union?
People want to say that they couldn't be dealt with. They actually were. One thing that they say, at least, that they're they're 100% on, is there's no solution with Ethiopian troops in the country. It's sort of this right. long-standing like enmity between the countries, and so they've
and they're not alone in that. It seems that the population of Somalia is also has this historical animus towards
and
you
I think exactly, and I think here's influence. Where the international community's kind of laziness and lack of focus, because first of all. No UN blue helmets were going to go in and fight the Islamic courts in the first instance back in December.
So
let's say the world kind of wanted the courts to be dislodged, but wasn't, you know, who else was going to do it? So it was sort of like Ethiopia do it. And Qatar tried to pass resolutions condemning the invasion, but it didn't fly. And so it was done. The thing is that since then, it's been, you know, 7 months now. The only way, it seems, to many, including me, but to many that I talked to in an interview, the only way that Congress is going to work with the Ethiopian troops there, it's to, you're never going to get rid of this insurgency. And so and they're never going to invite into the process people that are actively fighting the Ethiopian troops.
From an American perspective, though, you know, Ethiopia is our grand ally in the region. The United States at least seems unwilling to prod Ethiopia in directions that might help the situation on the ground in Somalia.
That's totally, and then we can say whether the wisdom of the U.S. There was recently this very detailed New York Times report about Ethiopian government's activities in its own borders against its rebels, Ogaden National Liberation Front, and others, but. It's not just a U.S. blame. It's to say, the African Union was supposed to replace the Ethiopian forces with an AU component, but maybe so far the only ones from the AU that are there are Ugandans. So they've suffered some losses. There's 1,500 of them out of 8,000 that were supposed to go. Other countries, Ghana said they wanted to send some, but they didn't have the transportation funds. It's kind of like, this is like, I hate to, I don't want to say it's like a Darfur. I'm not going to bring that analogy, but in the sense of an AU, but everyone at least knows of the AU force in Darfur, and there's talk about, you know, how can we strengthen it, let's have a hybrid. In Somalia, it's like an AU force on the cheap. They haven't even, if in fact there, you could have brought troops from Ghana to replace the Ethiopians, and most Somalis would have felt more comfortable with that.
Yes.
Why didn't one of these beneficent EU or US powers even from the US's perspective, it doesn't help Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. I think felt that when I say long term anonymity, it's that Somalia feels that part of Ethiopia belongs to it.
Right.
This is a real problem, and so Ethiopia was never going to allow an anti Ethiopian government to take shape in Mogadishu.
To your point about why the U.S. and Europeans doesn't support the African Union in Somalia, I think is a good one. You know, it would seem that it's almost a no-brainer.
Totally.
At the same time, there's not like an excess military capacity among African governments with militaries that are capable of taking on the kind of mission that would be required in Somalia.
Right, no, exactly. We can go over, there is a list, and it was, there were some, they were Burundi, various countries. I mean, again, it would have had to be sort of patched together among, but
it's not something that they would be able to pay for on their own.
No, there's no question. I mean, they would be providing the troops, and somebody else would have to pay for it. No question.
Yeah, and the European Union and the United States aren't being sort of generous with our offers, it seems. If we're not, able or willing or don't find in our interests to help transport Ghanaian troops across the continent to Somalia,
it's something that I find kind of, because it's so obviously, it's on the Security Council agenda, peace and security. It's one of, it's a country where you could say, you can kind of blame the international system, cut and run, right? After 1993, and it's sort of, you don't want to be always like, let's blame the international community, but this is a country that there have been a lot of screw ups by the international community, and this would be a time to kind of like step in and it really is not, it's not even like there's some the U.S. wants to have the Ethiopians in. It would be in the U.S.'s interest to get them out of there. They've already, I think the one thing is that the U.S. would be you know, unwilling to see these Islamic courts really like be given a place at the table. I think that they're not willing to have that. Although they say they want the reconciliation, they view the Islamic courts as antithetical to U.S. interest. And so,
I mean, this is where sort of American counterterrorism policy and wise foreign policy, you know, contradict.
Sure.
And that, you know, the Ethiopian are great allies against the, you know, terrorist menace in Somalia. So obviously we're not unwilling to cross them and prod them into you know, returning across their borders.
And here we go. We have another transition. Even though Somalia deserves more coverage, this is not like it didn't happen in the last week, but earlier this year there was a New York Times, and I have to tip my hat to them, story showing that despite the embargo against North Korea exporting military equipment, that a shipload of tank parts was allowed by the U.S. The U.S. was aware of the shipment and did nothing to stop it from North Korea to Ethiopia. And essentially, these are parts that are being used in Somalia. And so it was a bit, in a way, it's
like... I do remember seeing that article.
It's like a hypocrisy story, right? It's like the U.S. is saying to every, you know, the Chinese better search ships that leave there and all this. And then to an ally, it's sort of ironic. If the U.S. wanted to give tank parts to Ethiopia, they could have just done it themselves. Right. But so I know that you've written a piece saying that you know, the shutdown of the nuclear facility in North Korea. Well, go ahead. Let me not put words in your mouth.
Oh no. Well, I wrote a couple of pieces in the Guardian this week and last week, as well as some on UN Dispatch about how sort of recent progress in towards shutting down the North Korean nuclear reactor at Yongbyon goes to show that diplomacy can work, and it can be a foil to the proliferation aims of rogue regimes like in North Korea. And you had for the previous 5 years, from late 2002 until February of this year, sort of American policy was to not talk to the North Koreans, is to do more saber rattling and blustering than sort of actual negotiating, and we had this reversal of course in February of 2007, and since then we've made tremendous progress on nuclear disarmament in North Korea, and just this week the IAEA confirmed in fact that the North has shut down its nuclear reactor.
Mm-hmm. No, it was an extraordinary development. I think there are people, and not just like rabid red meat anti-North Korea U.S. ex ambassadors to the U.N., but some others.
Yes. Who are you talking about? Just say it.
John Bolton. The weird thing is that I think that there's an objective argument that says, if you were North Korea, they closed it down. And then you see, I guess Chris Hill was quoted saying, well, have they closed it all down? And it goes around and around. What I would almost want to say is, and I'm not sure how the two are which should be given more weight, or maybe one's unimportant. There is a Time Magazine expose, I believe it's in the current edition, I've only read it online, that describes in great detail something called, I think it's Bureau 39, and says the North Korean government of Kim Jong-il is an organized crime syndicate, and that it engages not only in counterfeit, but they actually grow poppies and export opium under a government brand label. Now, the weird thing about the story is, as a media maven, if this story had come out, even 8 months ago, it would have gotten a lot of play, because it's... The thing about it is that I think it's probably true. I mean, I don't think Time Magazine is not trying to build up its leadership,
Yes. I mean, I don't doubt that the regime of North Korea is chock full of terrible people. The aim of replacing that regime with another, like, nicer regime or unification of the peninsula is certainly noble, and one I would suggest. But, I'm most worried about... Yep. The North Koreans getting their hands in, which they have, on nuclear weapons, and so our goal would, I hope, our goal now is to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons, not changing their regime as Bolton has been advocating. Right. The fact is, from 2002 until February, when the U.S. pulled out of the agreed framework, and you know the North Koreans did, the North Koreans pulled out of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, kicked IAEA inspectors out of North Korea, developed a plutonium weapons program, and detonated a nuclear bomb in October. And you know it seems that this policy is so transparently a failure, and, and it's like a welcome moment of sanity among the Bush administration officials to actually engage North Korea and get them to give up these dangerous weapons.
Right. I was suddenly this is not a transition because I don't know where we'd go with it. But in terms of failed policy, it's like look at U.S. policy to Cuba. But we can. That's the strange thing is that there in some people's minds the two issues that North Korea is oppressive to its citizens and is an organized crime government. The nuclear issue become bound up, and in a way, you have to, so that's there really is no contradiction between the two stories. It's just that the world is, would breathe a sigh of relief. I guess there's some people, and I guess what I'm just saying is just logically, just a kind of man in the street. How would North Korea undo its nuclear, its at least threats to go nuclear, if not its nuclear threat, for $25 million? Is that all it took? Because that was the stumbling block.
I know.
Cheap.
That was the last stumbling block to letting inspectors back in the country was the U.S. releasing $25 million of frozen North Korean funds that were held in a Macau bank. Right.
I think the other argument could be that really it's so close to not a teetering regime, but people are really starving there. I mean, it's not just the $25 million. As soon as they said they would close it down, South Korea has sent a lot of grain,
has sent
fuel oil.
Yes.
So it could be that the government feels like they're just about, literally people are starving. And so I don't really know how much internal opposition there is. I don't really think there can be that much.
Yeah.
But this is a temporary game to get, to turn on those spigots of mostly South Korean, aid.
Yeah, and Japanese as well. But, you could call it a bribe.
Appeasement.
Bottom line is, for the first time in 5 years, the North Koreans have shut down their plutonium-producing facility.
I'm back to this idea of the man in the street. If you just putting yourself in their shoes, why would you shut it down all the way? I mean, if this is the only thing that's gotten you attention and aid, in a sense. That doesn't prove anything. I guess at some later stage when it's reported that things have, there's some people saying, have they poured wet cement into it or is it just temporarily turned off? But there's no question that it's good news,
Well, one theory, the reason that the U.S., the stated reason that the U.S. pulled out of the agreed framework in 2002 were accusations that North Korea had this secret side uranium enrichment program, and so the U.S. accused them of having that secret program in violation of the agreement. So the U.S. pulled out of the agreement, and then the rest is history.
Yep.
But now that since then, however, there have been doubts have been raised about whether or not this secret uranium enrichment program actually existed in the first place. Mm-hmm. And now that IAEA inspectors are in the country, we might find out, in fact, that there was no secret uranium enrichment program, and that it was just sort of an excuse to pull out of the Clinton administration's North Korea policy. I can't get into the head of Kim Jong-il, unfortunately.
Sure.
I don't know sort of what else they think they have to gain, other than keeping the bribes and the food going. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're more crippled than we think.
Right. I think
they're desperate for that $25 million.
The one thing that here within the UN, there's some thought because the UN hasn't really been engaged in that issue. And then now that there's a Secretary General that was the Foreign Minister of South Korea, there was this memo that got leaked. It was a Department of Political Affairs memo that was it laid out three options, but it really sort of was recommending one, which is that the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, his comparative advantage to get the UN involved in that and perhaps appoint a special envoy to the Korean Peninsula. And even there's some discussion of maybe there would be a UN trip led by him there before the end of the year. So there's this weird, and then... This, I guess I'm trying to use this to get to a I'm finding just on the sort of day-to-day coverage of the UN, there's a lot of there's grown to be this dispute around is Ban Ki-moon a Secretary General for the whole world, or are Korean issues and Korean advisors and others kind of a little top heavy? And it wasn't there were these two I guess editorials or op-eds.
There are accusations I think
sure.
leveled by yourself I think that he has something of a Korean kitchen cabinet.
Sure, I don't know there is, but I guess what I want to say is that those that, I want to try not to take the focus off. I'm willing to I'm continuing on that beat, and I think in a way the beat is transformed for me from being one in which it's like. It really is a transparency beat. It's just to say who are. I mean, most recently, the question. This is a sidetrack to the larger thing, but most recently the question is just okay. Who are there individuals from the mission to the UN of any member states that have routine access to the 38th floor and to the Secretary General? And it's a pretty simple question. And they've tried to say, well, there is no list. And Ban Ki-moon. Maybe this is a way to get back on track. Unprompted, by the way, not in response to a question on this topic, but in his rare press conference on Monday, he said, there are these allegations that I'm surrounded by Koreans. This is not true. You shouldn't report based on what you hear in the hallways, and it was kind of he was reading from notes. So this was something that he clearly wanted to say, and what he was responding to was, and this is it's wider than just hiring practices. There have been as the press tends to do, there was like the 100 days of ban stories. Now there's been, and maybe it was on a slight delay, there was a 6 months of ban stories, and two of them in England obviously definitely caught the 38th floor's eye. One was in the Guardian and was really a critique from the left. It was by a guy called Jonathan Steele, and it says basically too close to the Americans, that he went to Jerusalem and said, I'm in Israel, that he said that he is, it was focused a lot on Middle East and being seen as too close to the U.S. And then there was one in the Times of London, which my understanding is it's to the right, that was also criticized, critical. And so they've, I know for a fact that the communications director of Ban Ki-moon is a guy called Mike Meyer, who used to work for Newsweek, has been summoning correspondents upstairs. And, in a way, this is a kind of a get-to-know-you, no problem. But a question that's constantly asked is, where are you getting this stuff about hiring Koreans? I mean, it's just not the case. And who's telling you this? And there's this kind of,
this is the communication director, Mike Meyer, writing to Ban Ki-moon, is what you're saying.
Say again?
I lost you.
Summoning people that cover the UN.
Right.
Trying to sort of say, wait a minute, let's counter this negative coverage. So what we can do, what I'll do is he actually also wrote to the Guardian with I don't want to just sort of read it out, but it was a very interesting defense, and it sort of said it almost. I don't want to say he played the race card, but he said if people are saying Korean, it's as if you're saying there's not enough Europeans and knowledgeable people, and he has his own style, but he's not a shrinking violet. And essentially, I can't speak for them. He said, check out what he's done on Darfur and on climate change. This is a man that's getting things done.
Light again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Your light. Okay. I thought I was so incoherent that.
You're oozing coherence.
No, not really. I guess I just want to. His communications director, and it's I would say it's sort of their first kind of coming out swinging defense.
Okay.
Wrote to the Guardian and said. Implied that people, questioning how many Korean advisors he have, may be racist. I think that's the implication. Okay. But also said, look at what he's accomplished on Darfur and climate change. This is a man who can get things done. And so, to me, it's significant that these are kind of like the two, that he didn't respond to the Middle East criticism. It's like Darfur and climate change. We've just talked about Darfur. I don't know, do you feel, it sounds to me, from what you say about the right to, do you feel that the UN should be more aggressive, or the Secretariat should have said more forcefully, we're going in whether you agree or not?
I don't think it's the Secretariat has the ability to do that. It's something that I think member states ought to step up and do on their own. But the thing about like the UN and Darfur mm-hmm. is that, you know, like you said, the UN can mean a lot of different things. Yeah. You know, the General Secretariat, you know, Kofi Annan wrote the plan for Darfur mm-hmm. that the Security Council voted on last August.
Yep.
And on paper, the plan is pretty good. It, you know, it calls for a robust force. It calls for, you know, moves to help pacify the underlying political conflict. And it's a good piece of paper, and it was a good resolution. The problem is, you know, as we know, that the government of Sudan has been unwilling to let the peacekeepers in their country, and now, you know, we have news of some sort of breakthrough. At the same time, you know, I'm not convinced that the government of Sudan is negotiating in good faith, mm-hmm. and I think there's very little that Ban Ki-moon can do to twist the arm of the government of Bashir. I think that kind of diplomacy needs to take place bilaterally right. between, between member states, mm-hmm. between the United States, China, mm-hmm. Russia, and Sudan. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the United States is we have a lot bigger priorities with Russia and with China than over the situation in Darfur. Right. So we're more willing to, we want their cooperation in places like Iran, and now Kosovo, and Darfur seems to be taking a back seat.
Right.
So I think, the UN is almost getting blamed for the inaction of its member states.
No, I think, and normally, I mean, there are a lot of issues in which, and I don't totally disagree, but I think that in part, Ban Ki-moon has tried to. It's significant to me that these are the two issues that his head of communications
yes.
say are his crowning achievements of 6 months.
Yes.
So it's not like on Darfur he's just followed the Kofi Annan plot line. In fact, there was
yes.
this. There was a dynamic in which he said, the U.S. and the U.K. were saying, we want to put forward a resolution to make a no-fly zone over Darfur. We
yeah.
want more stringent sanctions. And Ban Ki-moon
yeah.
said, no, let me work my magic. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing. But essentially
yeah.
he said, give me some time.
Yes.
And let me use. Sometimes they call it the soft ear diplomacy. This has
yeah.
resulted. Not this is not me. This has resulted in. I read there was a piece in the Irish Sunday Herald, quoting the
yes.
head of a person that works for International Crisis Group and somebody from Aegis Trust, which is a known
yes.
organization in this field, both highly critical of Ban Ki-moon, saying he's
yes.
taking the pressure off President Bashir,
yes.
i.e. that even if somebody might have vetoed it, maybe China would have vetoed it. There was pressure ahead to show, we mean business. And then he said, no, give me some time. And he's come back announcing a victory, but this is their argument, but kind of share this analysis where it's, in a way, to say this has been a great victory 6 months. Is there a single piece of protection actually being provided by UN peacekeepers that wasn't at the beginning of the year? Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying he's failing either.
Well,
it just seems like a strange thing.
Well, I worry that like you said with Ban making this a sort of his signature issue and kind of personalizing it in a way,
yep.
is that he's setting himself up not necessarily for failure mm-hmm. because I don't think that he can has the ability to control events
sure.
all that much, but he will nonetheless take the blame.
But he's
for what yeah. is going to be a failure.
But then look,
the thing is that I don't think it's all that justified. On the level of who to blame over the situation in Darfur, I think Ban Ki-moon is ranks well below
sure.
the governments
yep.
of the Security Council.
No, I agree.
And he's going to take the fall for it because he's making it.
But he's also playing exactly. But you're dead on. My point is that if when challenged about what have you accomplished, they say these two
yes.
things. And I think
yes.
it also makes it then. It also makes him fully invested in this strategy of no, I'm the master behind the scenes diplomat. Watch me,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Give me more time, because I'm going to pull the fat out of the fire. It's also, just as a kind of cruel aside, this same relatively short, Team Ban, I'll call it, letter to the Guardian, also said it's surprising that a British journalist would be so critical when, you know, do you think the British sailors or Alan Johnstone of the BBC would have gotten out without our involvement? And I think a lot of people are like, yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. The problem is, and I think it's something that we've talked about before, is it's like a lot of times the UN or particularly the Secretary General and Secretariat gets blamed unfairly for things they couldn't have stopped. But you really shouldn't take credit for things you didn't do. Because then you create this, you know what I mean? It's sort of like live by the sword, die by the sword. I'm not saying that issuing a statement, I mean, maybe there's things we didn't understand, but it seemed to some this starting to go down this litany of, like, it seemed kind of desperate. Because, I mean, I don't know. Has the UK ever said, like, you know, God bless the UN, you freed the guys? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't mean to say that. It just seems sort of. But I guess what I'm trying to say, maybe it's a dynamic is emerging. No one knows, is it going to turn around or not? I'll just say that there, in this press conference he held Monday, there was a journalist that, like, stormed out and said, you know, the way the things are being run is not allowing, you know, critical of the UN to
be
asked.
Who is the journalist?
He's actually, I've referred to him before as Hezbollah TV, and I'll leave it.
Oh, right, yes.
He just today actually had a series of questions for this guy, Serge Brammert, the investigator of the Hariri trial. We won't walk through all that. So he's a known character here, but he wasn't the only one. At today's noon briefing, there was a kind of a defensive back and forth about the fairness. I think that I'll say one thing. We had, I don't think I can report on this, but the UN Correspondents Association, of which I'm a part, our board, we went and met with the communications head of the UN yesterday. And I won't say what he says, but one of the things that we tried to say to him is that it'll be, even if there's a critique of ban, and there is one that's kind of, I mean, a UN spokesperson of another unit said to me yesterday, ban seems to think it's 10 strikes and you're out. There's only 3. And that may be a little bit harsh. But
what does that mean?
Most basic things, they're screwing up. Here's a perfect example. There's an office called the Office of the Special Advisor on Africa. It was set up under Kofi Annan. It was occupied by a guy called Ibrahim Gambari, who's still in the system.
Yes.
But it was I don't want to say it was a bone they threw to the African continent, but it was saying, I think rightly, that, you know, most of the way that the UN deals with Africa is kind of like humanitarian aid, peacekeepers. This was an office that was sort of thinking about development. And I'd go to their events, and they were very kind of Afrocentric. The guy who held the office was called Laguela, Joseph Laguela, from Botswana. He wasn't, his contract wasn't renewed. He's gone. Everyone was waiting for a new one to be appointed, and suddenly it kind of leaked out, no, Ban Ki-moon's eliminating the office. And he is. I heard the rumor. They said, well, yeah. And so this has become an issue.
And you're critical of this move?
I'm a journalist, so I'm not, I'm certainly.
Or are you critical of the way in which
totally. And many people are. In fact, this is what, I'm answering your question of what, this is what this other unnamed UN spokesman said, is it was so, because here's the thing, it was that, it's one thing to do it, but he did it without, quote, consulting with the African group of countries. So that now, and this is I'm sure it's an inside the UN, you know, tempest in a teapot, but something called the Group of 77, which is a major player here. It's 130 countries. G77 and China, they've written to him protesting the move. Now, instead of just taking the medicine and saying, shoot, maybe next time we'll consult better, they've said, well, it's very unfortunate that the G77 letter was leaked before we received it. So it's turned into a real pissing match, and what a lot of people
between the developing world, the Secretary General, and the G77.
That is correct. That is correct. Yes. And so this is what the guy meant by 10 strikes and you're out. It's a stupid fight to pick, because you know what? It's only 16 jobs.
Now, how much of you know, these kind of moves are, you know, are maybe a consequence of Bond and his team only being on the job for 6 months. This is kind of like a learn-as-you-go.
That could be, but it all, you know, some people, I hate to say it, it also plays into this idea of not, and there's nothing, you know, racialist about this argument. If you surround yourself by people that this could have been avoided. You see what I mean? Somebody could have easily said to him, this is not worth it. And I'm not sure why he did it.
Yes.
I think he thought, maybe, I mean, actually, if you were running a private company and you analyzed a small office and said, you know what, it's redundant, or we can do it better somewhere else, screw it, you could probably do it, right?
Yeah.
This is the UN, though. And the question is, the sad part is that he needs the support, and the reference...
Well, I guess...
Right, that's a kind
that's
of a...
Part of the problem is that, you know, the office of the Secretary General is often, at least it was during the Annan era, is being, you know, the tool of the major powers, right. or particularly the United States. Well-meaning and well-intentioned, reforms that are proposed by the Secretary General are often blocked by the G77 and the developing world because they feel that it's encroaching on their territory and that their, proposed reforms, would come at their expense.
Right. No, absolutely, and I agree. And that's but that's why in the nitty gritty of things. I mean, I guess people would maybe could relate to. I'm trying to think of a Washington, inside the Beltway analogy.
Yeah.
But it's basically there's no question. Even they wouldn't have to say there's no question that it's a blunder because it's pissing off this group for no good reason when you need their votes on something else, totally outside of the merits of eliminating the office or not. I think in reality. And this is the way the UN as a kind of a system works. This was an African USG. This is a U.S. This is a it's a position of Undersecretary General. It's a serious position. So there's no way to spin it that it's not a loss of And especially the joke around has become now there'll be an office of the special advisor for the Korean Peninsula. But maybe that is it's not like to the victor go the spoils. It's just this is I think that there's a I think it has an effect on these foreign policy issues because, I mean, I think most people that like the UN and want to see world peace or want to see some kind of an alternative voice other than the U.S., for example, to the U.S., you really want the Secretary General to be perceived as sharp, to have a strong media voice, to have, to the degree possible, the General Assembly behind him, stuff like that. And so you don't to be critical of Ben is not necessarily to say he sucks or anything like that. It's just to say this is not if I think the weird some of the analysis came out is like the idea is that it's not going that well. I mean, and that's not maybe that's cruel. But
I think I just worry that it's too early. He's been on the job for 6 months.
Yep.
There are bound to be hiccups, mistakes. One would hope that his administration learns from the mistakes and next year, the year after that, and if he's renominated for a second 5-year term, that he develops into the role.
Right.
Which I think is something almost, that's every Secretary General has to, grow with the role.
Oh, sure, no, and I agree with all of that. Some people, I'm just saying that. May think that I'm just saying this for me, but I hear people saying here, like, how long is they're going to be saying, give us time? And 6 months is not forever. This is a media point, which is that I've come to think that they're. I mean, because I talk to reporters here, and I think that some people are like, I mean, I'll give you an example. And this guy said he can be quoted, but not by name. Major cable cable news venture that covers the UN has said their correspondent here can't get airtime because the statements aren't clear enough. It's not just that there's not. The one thing, Kofi Annan, whatever the critics say oil for food, other people say he was great, but he was always not just good with a quote. You see what I mean? If something was going on in the world and you stop him in the hall, he's going to say, it's an outrage, we're for human rights, we are the UN, and that's on the news. You'd see him on CNN at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
So it's not, it's not, the weird part is that there ends up being a kind of an almost a synergy between the press and the secretariat, because if the places, I mean, like this, if you work for a major cable network, You need to get airtime. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there. I mean,
no,
you know what I mean. So it's
He doesn't offer the kind of sound bites like Kofi Annan would.
I think it seems superficial, but the reality. So then you started. Another unnamed cable venture started feeding questions in advance to the spokesperson's office to say, this is what we're going to ask at the stakeout. And so I think I was surprised by that because I think that I think it's important just as a matter of credibility to know if the questions were given in advance or if they're fresh, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that the press and Bond did not get off on the best foot. Mm-hmm. I seem to recall that some of your colleagues whipped up a media frenzy like the day after he was installed because in comments he didn't. Use the traditional UN line in condemning capital punishment, and he had to correct himself a few days later. And he'd been on the job for a day, and he's getting trashed immediately. And, you know, it's no surprise to me, at least, that he's so defensive.
Right.
Also, you know, considering the trashing that Kofi Annan got at the end of his term, I'm, again, not surprised that Bond would recoil from press attention.
Right, but But, I mean, Kofi Annan, to his credit, and it's not just, you know, it's obviously, it's not to, you know, compare somebody's diction or quipsterism, but to I will say this, to his credit, this is not a guy that hid from the press at all. You know what I mean? You could stop him in the hall, and he would stop, and he would say, you know, and he, you know, he faced the, he want, you know, he got in trouble somehow for dressing down one of the correspondents here and calling him an overgrown schoolboy. But, I mean, but he didn't not take the questions, and I think, least right now, amongst at least some of my colleagues, there's a sense that these guys are trying to hide from the questions. And I think the message that was tried to be delivered by the UN Correspondents Association is that that's not the road to take. It's much better to take the questions and maybe not answer them perfectly, maybe answer them angrily, whatever you want to do, but that it doesn't work here, especially, and I guess the analysis goes, you know, like the Pope, he doesn't have his own army. You know what I mean? The power of the office is, in a way, being a voice. And to be a voice, you can't hide from the microphone. And it's not, you can't, and the way, at least the way it works here is you can't just unilaterally say something and then walk away. If you're going to choose to say, I'm grabbing this issue, then you got to take questions on that issue. And you're free, you're free to, you know, so whatever, I'm saying you, like, but I think, and it's an open question. This is, I'm not, it's, I think everybody here, whatever their position, including just journalists that want to, like, get airtime on their cable channel, want things to go well, you know. I was going to say better, but we could say well, and it's an open question whether they will.
All right. Well, we'll have to keep watching.
Yeah, whatever.
And keep reporting back.
Sure.
And
Kosovo. You know, Kosovo, baby.
Maybe, yeah.
Tomorrow, 11 a.m. Be there.
Let's see. All right, Matthew.
Okay.
Thanks a lot again.
Definitely. And I want to just put a plug. I hope that in our online presentation here, we'll have links to your back and forth with Mr. Megadeth, because that was of much interest.
Okay, well, we can delve into that.
We can definitely.
Briefly, one second. last plug. So this is an item of world historical importance. Earlier in the week, last week, I wrote a verse by verse critique, if you will, of the lyrics to the title track of Megadeth's new album.
Can we call it exegesis?
An exegesis, if you will, of their album called United Abominations. You know, it was kind of fun to write. The album features art depicting a 9/11 style attack of the UN, and the lyrics of the song are just kind of your typical Rush Limbaugh-esque anti-UN talking points, and I had kind of fun dissecting the lyrics. It got picked up on a lot of heavy metal discussion boards, and Dave Mustaine, the lead singer to Megadeth, was forced to issue a lengthy response to me, and so UN Dispatch and Megadeth had a bit of a feud last week, the benefits of which UN Dispatch got in links and hits to our website.
There
so,
you go. And I don't know if he would force, just to speak for Megadeth for a moment, if I can.
I don't
know if he was forced. I mean, I think he did, and I think that's too, you know, I'm not crediting, people are free to read what he wrote, but, you know, he didn't,
yeah.
I think he even said, like, that he was happy to have been somehow taken seriously. So it's, you know, so.
Well, you know, the most brilliant part of his response, which was issued on the website of his record label, was, He admitted that he got the facts wrong, but he said that it still felt right.
Right.
You know, he's happy to get the facts wrong.
Well, he's an artist.
It feels so good, yeah.
But
I'd rather be wrong and feel right. It's the.
But I mean, I think
quote,
I think.
I'm out of light right here. Okay. Back.
Okay. that to have. I mean, I think that some without again speaking for Mr. Megadeth. To have, I think that probably, as I believe he said, a lot of his listeners may never have heard of Rwanda and stuff like that. So in a sense, I'm not saying like there's some, you know, a silver lining in the cloud for the UN system, but I think that anything, I mean,
in all seriousness, I actually do think there is, because, you know, if you look at the comments in the message board, you know there is some discussion, and, you know, some fairly serious discussion about their, you know, role of the UN, and, you know, this is among the headbanger demographic.
Sure.
So,
and not even the role of the UN.
Sometimes just spark a thoughtful discussion about the UN and diplomacy. That's
And sometimes just, I mean, literally, I mean, as time goes on, I don't know if you, you know, it depends where you take the poll. There's many people that never heard of what happened in Rwanda not that long ago, you know what I mean? I think even if somebody is bringing a UN critical analysis of it, it's still at least, I mean, it's important because, so whatever.
He doesn't mention Rwanda in the song, though. He calls the United Nations the Antichrist.
I'm going to call that hyperbole.
He's not that nuanced. Yeah.
Hyperbole. It's hyperbole, but on that note, I'm going to tell you to rock on, Mark. Just keep on
rocking. All right, you too, Matthew. Keep digging up the dirt, you know, and keep it coming, and, you know, we'll chat in the future.
Okay, excellent.
All right,
okay.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.